Chapter 35. Julia was thankful when darkness arrived. Moving through the shadows along the outside deck of the towboat toward the bow, she slipped over the side onto the barge and hid amid the black plastic bags of trash. She was not happy about the faint light thrown by a waning moon, but it enabled her to keep track of crew movements on board the towboat and to observe the countryside for geographical references as to location. She also followed the direction of her progress by glancing up every few minutes at Polaris, the North Star. Unlike the featureless landscape of the central Atchafalaya Valley, the grassy banks of Bayou Teche supported a thick canopy of live oak trees, interspersed with stately cypresses and lithe willows. But like the edge of a checkerboard, the tree belt opened up every mile to reveal lights of farmhouses and dim, moonlit fields of newly planted crops. Behind fenced pastures, Julia could make out the shapes of cattle grazing. She recognized the sound of a meadowlark and fleetingly wished that she had a family and a home. She knew the day was not far off when her superiors at INS would curtail her hazardous attempts to stop Chinese immigrant smuggling operations and put her behind a desk. The towboat and barge passed what seemed a picturesque fishing town that Julia would later learn was Patterson. Docks lined the waterfront with fishing trawlers taking up almost every slip. She made a mental note of how the town was laid out along the bayou as it receded in the distance. The towboat captain blew his air horn as a drawbridge drew into sight. The bridge tender dutifully tooted his horn in reply and raised the span to allow passage. A few miles above Patterson, the towboat slackened its speed and began easing toward the west bank. Peering over the side of the barge, Julia could see a large warehouse-like brick structure with several outer buildings that were spaced around a long dock. A high chain-link fence with barbed wire strung along the top encircled the compound. A few scattered floodlights, with dim and dusty bulbs in their sockets, ineffectually illuminated the open area between the dock and warehouse. The only sign of life Julia could see was a guard who exited a little shack and stood at a closed gate on the end of the dock. She noted that he was wearing the common uniform sold by private security services. Through a window of the shack, she could see the reflected images of a television screen. Her heart gave a leap when she spied a pair of railroad tracks that ran down a concrete culvert under the big warehouse. She believed with growing certainty that this was the main staging center from where the illegals were transported to their predetermined destinations. Once there, they were either enslaved or released into heavily populated metropolitan cities. She burrowed under the trash bags as the Chinese crew came aboard the barge and tied it to the dock. When the barge was secure, they leaped back on board the towboat. There was no word spoken between the captain, crew, and the guard behind the gate. The captain gave a brief blast on his air horn to signal his intentions to a small shrimp boat about to pass by. The towboat slowly reversed away from the barge, swinging its stern wide until a 180-degree turn was completed, and the flat-nosed bow was pointing down the bayou. Then the captain engaged forward, increased speed, and set the towboat on a course back toward Sungari. The next 20 minutes were spent in a strange silence that began to frighten Julia. Not from personal fear of her safety, but a dread that perhaps she had made a mistake. The guard had long since returned to his shack and his television. The barge, full of trash, lay moored to the dock, dismissed and neglected. Julia had contacted Captain Lewis aboard the Weehawken soon after her leap onto the towboat and informed him of her reckless enterprise. Lewis was not a happy camper when he realized that the woman whose safety was in his hands had taken a terrible risk. Professional that he was, he brushed aside his frustration and ordered a launch full of armed men under Lieutenant Stowe to follow the towboat and barge as a backup to the helicopter. His only order to Stowe was to keep a respectful distance behind the towboat and not arouse suspicion. Julia could hear the whine of the helicopter's engines and see its navigation lights in the night sky. She well knew the fate that awaited her if Chin Chang's smuggling enforcers apprehended her, and it gave her a warm feeling to know she was being watched over by men who were willing to lay their lives on the line to save her if worst came to worst. She had long before removed Lin Wan Chu's cook clothes and crammed them into a plastic trash bag. Not so much because they were now incongruous, but because the white cloth would have made her visible to anyone on the towboat when she stood up to stare over the side of the barge during the journey from Sungari. Underneath, she wore simple shorts and a blouse. For the first time in nearly an hour, she spoke into her miniature radio and hailed Lieutenant Stowe.
"The towboat has dropped off the barge and moored it alongside a dock near what looks like a large warehouse."
Lieutenant Jefferson Stowe, in command of the launch, answered quickly over the transmitter and receiver set around his head. "We confirm. The towboat is about to pass us, going in the opposite direction. What is your situation?"
"About as exciting as watching a tree become petrified. Except for a security guard on the other side of a tall fence, who's busy watching a TV program in his shack, there isn't another soul in sight."
"Are you saying your objective is a washout?" asked Stowe.
"I need more time for an investigation," answered Julia.
"Not too long, I hope. Captain Lewis is hardly a patient man, and the helicopter only has another hour of fuel left, and that's only the half of it."
"What's the other half?"
"Your decision to jump on the towboat came so fast none of my crew or I got dinner."
"You're joking."
"Not about growing Coast Guardsmen missing a meal," Stowe said humorously.
"You will stand by and not desert me?"
"Of course," replied Stowe, the humor in his voice quickly fading. "I only hope the towboat didn't simply park the barge overnight in expectation of moving it to a trash fill in the morning."
"I don't think that's the case," said Julia. "One of the buildings has a railroad siding leading in and out of it. This place would make an ideal layout to transport smuggled immigrants to destinations around the country."
"I'll request Captain Lewis to check the railroad company for freight train schedules that call for stops at the mill," Stowe offered reasonably. "Meanwhile, I'll run the launch into a small inlet across the bayou about 100 yards south of you. We'll stand by here until I hear otherwise." There was a slight pause. "Miss Lee?"
"Yes?"
"Don't get your hopes up," said Stowe evenly. "I've just spotted a shabby, run-down sign that's sitting at a crazy angle on the bank of the bayou. Would you like to know what it says?"
"Yes, do tell me," Julia answered,
deliberately robbing her words of irritation. "Felix Bartholomew Sugar Processing Plant Number 1. Established 1883. You're apparently moored at a long-abandoned sugar mill. From my vantage point, the complex looks deader than a fossilized dinosaur egg."
"Then why would it be protected by a security guard?"
"I don't know," Stowe replied honestly.
"Hold on," Julia snapped unexpectedly. "I heard something."
She went quietly, listening, and Stowe cooperated by asking no questions. As if far away, she heard the muted clank of metal against metal. At first, she thought it came from somewhere within the deserted sugar mill, but then she realized the sound was muffled by the water beneath the barge. Furiously, she threw the plastic trash bags aside until she could squirm a passage down to the bottom of the barge's hull. Then she pressed her ear against the damp, rusting metal of the bilge keel. This time she heard muffled voices whose vibrations telegraphed through the steel. She could not distinguish words, but what she heard came through as men shouting harshly. Julia fought her way back to the top of the trash bag pile, checked to see the guard was still occupied, and then leaned over the side of the barge, peering down into the water. There were no telltale lights in the depths, and it was too dark to see more than a few inches past the surface.
"Lieutenant Stowe," she said softly.
"I'm here."
Can you see anything in the water between the dock and the barge?
Not from here, but I have you in view.
Julia instinctively turned and stared across the bayou, but all she saw was darkness.
You can follow my actions?
Through a night vision scope. I didn't want anybody sneaking up on you without you knowing about it. Good old faithful Lieutenant Stowe. Another time, another place, she might have felt a growing affection for him. But any thought of love, no matter how fleeting, created an image of Dirk Pitt in her mind. For the first time in her life, she was infatuated with a man, and her independent spirit was not sure how to accept the situation. Almost reluctantly, she refocused her concentration on discovering the covert methods of Chin Shang's smuggling operation.
I believe there must be another vessel or compartment connected to the bottom of the barge, she reported.
What are the indications? Asked Stowe.
I heard voices through the keel. That would explain how the Chinese were able to smuggle the illegal immigrants through Sungari and past immigration, customs, and the Coast Guard.
I'd like to buy your theory, Miss Lee, but an underwater compartment that is carried across two oceans from China and then shifted under a barge for a voyage up a Louisiana bayou to a railroad terminal and an abandoned sugar mill may get you an award for literary fiction, but it won't score you any points with pragmatic minds.
I'll stake my career on it, Julia said positively.
May I ask your intent? Stowe's tone went from friendly to official.
I intend to gain entry into the mill and make a search.
Not a smart move. Better to wait until morning.
That may be too late. The immigrants could be herded into freight cars and transported away by then.
Miss Lee, said Stowe coldly, I strongly urge you to think this thing out and back off. I'll swing the launch across the bayou and pick you up off the barge. Julia did not feel that she had come this far suddenly to walk away.
No, thank you, Lieutenant Stowe. I'm going in. If I find what I hope to find, you and your men can come running.
Miss Lee, I must remind you that although you're under the protection of the Coast Guard, we are not a Justice Department SWAT team. My advice, if you wish to take it, is to wait until daylight, obtain a search warrant from a parish judge, and then send in the local sheriff to investigate. You'll score more points with your superiors that way. It was as though Julia had not heard Stowe.
Please ask Captain Lewis to notify Peter Harper in Washington and alert the INS office in New Orleans. Good night, Lieutenant Stowe. Let's do lunch tomorrow.
Stowe tried several times to raise Julia, but she had turned off her little radio. He looked across the bayou through his night vision scope and saw her jump from the barge and run the length of the dock, disappearing around a moss-covered oak tree outside the chain-link fence. Julia stopped when she reached the oak and hid for a few minutes under the moss that hung from the branches above. Her eyes slowly panned around the seemingly deserted buildings of the sugar mill. No lights inside the doors and windows leaked through the weathered cracks. She listened, but only heard the rhythmic whine and rasp of cicadas, an indication that summer was just around the corner. The balmy air lay heavy and damp, with no breeze to cool skin moist with sweat. The main building in the complex, solid and substantial, stood three stories tall. The founder must have been influenced by medieval architecture. Ramparts traveled around the roof with four turrets that once held the company's offices. The walls showed only enough windows to provide daylight for the interior. But to the men and women who had once labored there, the lack of ventilation must have caused incredibly oppressive working conditions. The red clay bricks looked as if they had long defied the mugginess, but green moss and climbing vines were slowly invading their mortared seams, loosening their grip. Already, a large number of them had fallen to the damp earth below. To Julia, the unearthly scene of a once thriving business humming with activity, crowded with people but now abandoned,
wore the expectant air of a place long overdue for the Wreckers' Ball. She worked her way through the shadows of the vegetation growing along the fence until she came to the railroad tracks leading through a heavily padlocked gate, down the culvert, and ending at a massive wooden door opening into the basement of the main warehouse. She bent down and studied the rails under a light on a nearby pole. The steel was shiny and free of rust. Her cocksure conviction was now becoming more firmly established. She continued her renaissance, flitting silently with the grace of a cat through the underbrush, until she came to a small drainage pipe 2 feet in diameter that ran under the fence before emptying in a ditch parallel to the old mill. She made a quick survey of the immediate area to check that she was still unobserved and began crawling into the pipe, pushing herself feet first so she could scramble forward if it proved to be a dead end. Julia was by no means lulled into a false sense of security. It puzzled her that only one guard appeared to be working for a security service other than Tsim Shan Maritime. The lack of extra guards and brighter floodlighting suggested that this was a facility holding little of value. Perhaps the very image that was meant to be projected. She was too much the professional not to consider the likely possibility that her movements were recorded by concealed infrared video cameras from the time she jumped from the barge until now. But she had come too far to quit. If this was a staging area for illegal immigrants, then Tsim Shan wasn't operating under his usual formula of fanatical secrecy and tight security. A broad-shouldered man might never have squirmed through the drainage pipe, but Julia had inches to spare. At first, all she saw when she looked between her feet was blackness. But after negotiating a slight bend in the pipe, she saw a circle of moonlight playing in a reflection of water. Mobile as she gazed to her left and right. No sirens, no mad attack dogs, no searchlights greeted her entry into the sugar mill compound. Content that her presence wasn't detected, she stealthily moved along the building, searching for a way to enter. She pressed her back against the moss-covered brick walls, deciding on which direction to take around the sugar mill. The side where the railroad track sloped off into a basement was open and washed from the light on the pole, so she chose the opposite course, which offered dark shadows from a grove of cypress trees. She stepped as noiselessly as possible, careful not to fall over any old rubbish that lay scattered about the ground. A small thicket of brush blocked her way, and Julia crawled under it. Her outstretched, probing fingers touched a stone step, and then a second one leading downward. Squinting her eyes, she peered into the shadows and discovered a stairway dropping to the basement of the mill. The steps were covered with debris, and she carefully had to step around and over it. The door at the bottom of the stairs had seen better days. Stout and made of oak, at one time it could have stopped a battering ram. About a century of damp climate had rusted out the hinges, and Julia found that all she had to do was give it a hearty kick for the door to creak open just far enough to allow her to squeeze past. Julia hesitated only long enough to see that she was in a concrete-walled passage. There was a faint glow of light at the other end, a good 50 feet away, she guessed. The dank smell from the long, unused passage lay heavy. The floor was dripping damp and puddled in places where rainwater had seeped in from the outer door. Debris and old furniture cast into the passageway when the sugar mill closed down made it difficult to pass through without undue sounds. She became extra cautious when she reached the dim light that shone through the dirty glass window of a heavy oak door blocking the way. She carefully turned a rusting door handle. Unexpectedly, the bolt slid whisper silent from its slot. Then she painstakingly eased the door open a crack. It swung on its hinges as smoothly as if it had been oiled only the day before. She softly stepped inside with the expectation of a woman anticipating trouble. She found herself inside an office furnished in the heavy oak furniture so popular in the early part of the 20th century. Julia froze. The room was immaculately clean. There wasn't a speck of dust or a cobweb to be seen. It was like entering a time capsule. She had also stepped into a trap. She felt as if she had been punched in the stomach when the oak door clunked shut behind her, and three men stepped from behind a screen that shielded a sitting room at the other end of the office. All of the men were dressed in business suits, two carrying briefcases as though they had just come from a board of directors meeting. Before she could transmit over her hidden radio, her arms were pinned and her mouth taped shut.
"You are a most obstinate young lady, Ling Tai.
Or should I call you Julia Lee?" said Ki Wong, Chin Chang's chief enforcer, as he gave a curt bow and grinned satanically. "You don't know how happy I am to meet you again." Stowe stared across the bayou as he pressed the receiver against his ear with one hand and held the microphone of the transmitter until it nearly touched his lips. "Miss Lee, if you read me, please answer." He heard what seemed to be stifled voices for a moment before all communications with Julia went dead. His first instinct was to rush across the bayou and charge the gate on the wharf. But he could not be certain Julia had encountered a life-threatening situation. Surely not certain enough to risk the lives of his men in a combat engagement. Another factor that preyed on his mind was the possibility of ambush on territory that was unknown. Stowe took the route used by astute officers since the first military force was formed. He laid the responsibility on his superior officer.
"Weehawken, this is Lieutenant Stowe."
"We read you," came the voice of Captain Lewis.
"Sir, I believe we have a situation.
Please explain."
"Contact has been lost with Miss Lee."
There was a few moments' pause. Then Lewis replied slowly.
"Remain in your position and keep the sugar mill under surveillance. Report any new information. I'll get back to you."
Stowe stood in the launch and gazed across the bayou at the silent and dark buildings.
"God help you if you've run into trouble," Stowe muttered softly. "Because I can't.